All right, what I looked at today was I want to do Haddon Robinson's chapters 6 and 7. I want to talk about your repeat sermons and what you thought of that. And it's possible we'll get to Eugene Lowry's The Lowry Loop, that handout I gave you. I have a PowerPoint on that, and I want to talk about that. I think it's a really important thing to sort of discuss and get to, but if we don't get to it today, we'll get to it next Wednesday. This is how I look at it coming up. Monday we have to meet first period, right? Now, how will that work? This Friday we need two messages. Who's going to speak this Friday? Brad?
Something about a 9th and 12th. Is that me?
Oh.
Or is that something?
Well, we have 9th's not our class, I don't think, but the 10th. And we want two on Friday and one on Monday, or if you want two on Monday and one on Friday, we can do it that way. It's just depends on when you're ready to go. You'll go Friday? All right. Brad will go Friday. Okay. What about you? You'll go Friday, too. So Angie and Brad on Friday, Zach on Monday the 12th. Next Wednesday, that'll be the 14th, we'll do Haddon Robinson chapters 8 and 9. And then Friday the 16th, that will be the first batch of repeats for the sermon. So who would like to go on the 16th Friday? And well, we'll be doing it Monday, too. So once again, I mean, Brad should probably go since you'll be a week away at that point. Okay. On Friday. Do you want to do it Friday then, the 16th, Zach? Okay. No, we don't need to. We can do the Monday.
I can't do my, I'd rather do my Friday too, because I have a chapel speak on that Monday as well.
On the 19th?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Then Wednesday the 21st, we'll do Robinson chapter 10. We'll, if we haven't gotten to Lowry, we'll get to him then. And I want to tie up any loose ends. There's a lot of end material in Robinson, you've noticed, sort of a exercise kind of material. It's past the point of the chapter 10, but it's all the sample sermon and evaluation, two large appendices there. I'm not willing to give up this children's sermon thing. If nothing else, it will be on the last day of class. So we'll work from there. So do you have that schedule down? This Friday, we're going to hear from Angie and Brad. And it's your final message. Before we do the discussion of repeats, let me just give you my overall take on it at this point. I think everybody improved. I don't know if you felt they improved. It's a little bit more of a challenge to listen because, of course, I've heard it before. And in particular, that one day we had a long chapel speaker, so you would have listened to three messages in 3 hours. That can tax anybody's imagination or ability to perceive things and evaluate them clearly. I felt everybody improved. I felt you moved some elements around. Presentations themselves were more confident and more direct. I would say once again, I would keep this in mind. You do tend to be didactic. Remember what I said about that? What is didactic? Teaching. So you're in that mode. You're college students, so of course everything's didactic. It's a little more information than you need to give. I think in some ways, I think you can all the talks could be simplified. I said you can be simple without dumbing down. The thoughts can be profound, but the amount of verbiage is less dense. The subject's pulled down to maybe more. You talk about fewer ideas in a little more depth. I guess maybe that's it. It's just the range of ideas that are being presented. But that's so typical of a classroom. Lots of ideas flying around a classroom. Messages like this ought to have maybe a few ideas, and you spend more of your time pushing them out, developing them, illustrating them, coming back round to them. So think about that. For the most part, you're completely still very deductive, and I think that's, I really wonder about the deductive-inductive split in messages like that. I think it can be overstated and overworked. What I tend to think of is rather than maybe deductive-inductive overall, the deductive's probably where beginning people ought to go, but they ought to consider the inductive elements. And I said that to you last time as well. I mean, tease out your questions, your images, let people savor them a little bit. I noticed that, Zach, I felt you did that a little more, and I liked it. You took the inductive elements of what you were working with and let them hang a little bit longer so that we could get some of the tension that was there. Anything else I wanted to tell you? No, I would say that's it. I'd say that the didactic and simplify thing I would take very, very seriously here. If you're not preaching to college students, if you're teaching in our chapel, it would probably be appropriate. Now, the other thing to say is, and I've said this before here, that you know all this stuff now. The question is, will you apply it? So, what I really wanted to suggest that you do when you prepare this next message is do the stuff that Robinson and the handouts have recommended that you do for the message. Look for hermeneutical ideas and exegetical ideas. Look for that idea that pulls it all together. Think in terms of subjects and complements. Think in terms of maybe inductive elements and teasing out questions like that. Apply it. So I say, before you write this next message, do that stuff. You know, don't just say, okay, I've learned that, and then go and do whatever you were going to do anyway, but actually apply it. You have the handout by Stott that came from Zenos Fellowship. I think that's probably a pretty good summary. But leaf through Robinson, and in particular, move ahead as you're skimming back through Robinson. See what he has to say coming up before you do your message. But that would be just my general take on things. Let's talk about it more specifically here. Let me get the right sheet here. Talk about everybody's message. Okay. Brad, you did the first second take, didn't you? What was your experience working with it? Did you feel you got to improve it at all?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's really hard for me to notice a big difference in, you know, just getting in and like moving stuff around, and when I read through it a second time, I don't usually look at it like, oh, that's this part's better than this part's better. I know one thing I did do is compress a lot. Like, I found myself deleting a whole lot of like extra words and then combining bullet points and that kind of stuff. So that was out of anything. That's the thing I noticed myself doing in those. Which, I mean, that did help to compact it.
What did you? How did you receive it a second time, Zach and Angie? How well did it work for you hearing it? I know, once again, I said you wouldn't be in that situation. But part of my goal here is that we're not thinking critically enough if we listen to our own message and think, I don't know how to improve that, or I'm going to not bother improving that. Think, well, no, anybody at any level of preaching should be able to look back and say, this was the weaker part, this is the stronger part, this is how I would do it the next time, and that's what I'm working on here.
Kind of failing on the details of it. I know, I enjoyed it better. I think one thing that stuck out just his introduction right off the bat. Like, he still had, you know, the imagery, the picture out loud, really like that. But then even before that, he talked just a little bit, even preliminary before that. And I thought that added something, and I thought he kind of brought us into it better this time. Let's see.
I thought he was clever with what he said, and one thing that I enjoy is him breaking down like the tabernacle and like what it was for. Even though I mean, I already knew that, but as a church audience, I was able to kind of follow, understand more what he was in and the veil and those things. I mean, it worked. It whatever he did extra worked for me.
What I wrote, among other things, just at the beginning, Brad, is that I thought you teased out your beginning more. I thought a lot of you did that. Well, I just thought you started better. I kind of knew where you're going. I don't think that was just a function of kind of knowing already, having heard you give one version of this sermon again, but if you teased it out a little bit more at the beginning, and kind of pull people in, I felt like that was very well done. Your image of the curtains and that, I think you made it much more inductive. The idea of the torn divider and using that as kind of a language going there. I thought your reading then of the passage, as I said, that was another thing I emphasized last time. I was saying, work on your reading, make it a punchline, make it significant, was well done. I thought you could probably have delivered the key verse with a little more flourish, but I thought the reading overall was well done. The veil's truths, what did the veil mean? I think I got all of that. I felt like you got the PowerPoint shut off, and that was good. I felt like keeping the Exodus and Leviticus passages in was a good idea, and the Day of Atonement. The atonement cover versus the mercy seat, we talked about that. I wondered about that. I'd never... I don't know, I've read the NIV through many, a couple times anyway. I've never gotten that. Did you notice he was saying atonement cover, where most traditional language would have said the mercy seat? That one perplexed me. I don't know how that works for you. I think you'd have to know your culture a little bit to know. If they're used to King James language, though, that it wouldn't be obvious to you that the mercy seat turned into the atonement cover in a modern translation like that. I thought you got an interesting, tricolon of adverbs there. I forget what it was. You were talking about speaking something loudly, vividly, and boldly. What were you referring to there? You used those three. Well, it doesn't matter. I just think groups of three are always very powerful. If you took, you all took public speaking, so you know that tricolon idea, that three statements of three somehow or other are very memorable and work with people.
The single line in Mark should speak more loudly and vividly. And I might have thrown boldly in there just because I thought of it and reminded about what each event this was theologically.
Okay, I thought you had, you talked to use the term sacrificial inadequacy. I felt like that was a good term. I mean, it was sophisticated without being incomprehensible. And I felt when you came down the home stretch, I wrote that you had a good change of pace. It seemed like I sensed we're moving to the end now. The pace has picked up. We've hit a kind of a gallop that was just right there that worked with it. Permanently torn, embrace Christ, and victory in Jesus sort of is how the end of it is how I read the whole thing, that we had this. What I did write was with Hebrews, the passage from Hebrews you worked 6 through 19 through 20, and I discussed this before. I mean, could we have gone without that? I don't know. Melchizedek's a mouthful, and and such a mystery at that. You know, you think, well... do we need that in there?
When I read looking at it, that's one thing I asked, someone in a situation like that, how much do you say background before your people are sitting there thinking, okay, well, this doesn't have anything to do with what you're talking about, but at the same time, explaining so you're not just flying through something and people are still stuck on.
Mm-hmm. I don't know, Melchizedek's probably... I'm trying to think of it. It depends on how biblically literal your congregation is. I'm going to guess Locust Grove. They know who Melchizedek is. They know what you're referring to. I think probably for the average American Christian, they kind of vaguely know they read that once in Hebrew, and they don't really know what it's about. It might just send a few people out into Melchizedek land, and they're too busy trying to puzzle it out to catch you right at the end when you really need to keep that connected focus. Anyway, I'd consider it if I were doing that one again, but that's how I was looking at it. Well, what do you think? Is it worth it to try the exercise of repeating these?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it was somewhat, I don't know, I find reworking stuff somewhat aggravating in some ways because I'm trying to pare it down, and I've already given it once, so I know what I want to say. But as far as how do I take these two points and put them together? Although with extra words. The second time around, I can easily pick that up, like reread sections, be like, okay, well, this is long, I don't need these 5 words, and take them out. Like, I did a lot of that the second time, too. Overall, it was good. I mean, I definitely did it better.
I'm sure you would all find more energy in the process if we had a congregation here that shifted, you know, got to give it in a new environment, but it's artificial enough to give a sermon to a class. That's an artificial environment and got a lot of make-believe involved in it. But had you an audience, I think it would be different. I haven't given a lot of sermons twice in my life. I tend to rework fresh from my material. On the other hand, I think, but I've preached on the same passages, I know, multiple times. Undoubtedly, I've gone back over it in my mind and, you know, given it differently, preach a different sermon at age 30 than I would at age 50 on that particular passage. And undoubtedly, I'm reworking that material. I just think it's very important to as I said, to listen, say, what can I improve? Take what I did well, and leave behind what I did poorly. Angie, you did your second attempt next, I guess. How was the experience?
It was a little better, but like right there in school, like, I was just thinking about like all the constructive criticism and like really careful stuff, and like, it worked out that way. Yeah, was. I feel like I thought about it more, like what my message is truly about. I think I sat down and thought about it more than rather just like trying to get a message, you know, create a message.
How did it work for you guys, Angie's second time through?
I think there was more clarity in me, that's one thing. And it is, but it still kept that same style. That I really like, not so much, I guess, more teaching / inductive and deductive. I really like that.
Zach, any reflections?
I agree. I think it was clear and better presented the second time. Did you make like certain points necessarily? Like, I know you didn't have like a 3 or 4 point or anything, but I guess it may be just from I enjoy when I hear something. Like, you kind of you had a lot of passages I know, and you're going through, and sometimes I myself, even if I have like nothing to kind of gauge where we're at or like when I'm moving out, and like, kind of get lost somewhere, but when people make like at least one or two points, they stop and say, okay, this here's the point, and then move on to something, kind of gives me something so I guess that would maybe more on the provide point on the constructive side that I didn't quite see, because sometimes we go on and keep talking, move past the passions. I mean, I got what you were saying, I did, but it's when you make like certain stop and say, so this is the point for something here, it kind of helps me to have it through the whole thing. Overall, I thought it was improved.
I thought your presentation was much stronger, just as a speaker, you know, not evaluating the content of it. I felt like there's more confidence in it or something. I don't know. It just flowed a little better for me. I thought it was very...
I just say she made a lot of eye contact. She didn't look down very much. I mean, I guess once she got up and started talking, she knew what she wanted to say. She didn't have to go up there, and she was engaging us, I thought, more.
I thought you started really, really strong with it. You know, it was clear where you were going. You talked about Jesus was our blood on the door and things like that. I felt that was very good. Actually, that whole beginning part of it, I almost felt like you could cut that in two and have two very good sermons. Particularly when you got to that place, is what is your Egypt, and talking about what your Egypt was personally, and then whatever your Egypt, leave your Egypt on the cross. Well, you could cut that off right there and have a really good sermon. That would be a 15-20 minute sermon with a little bit of elaboration. I thought that one would be fine in some ways. I thought, okay, let's just call it quits there. But then, of course, you went on. You were after your Easter topic. I felt like your Pennsylvania Turnpike example was pretty good. I felt like at least in people who have been in Pennsylvania know what that means. I don't know what that would mean to somebody who doesn't know what that would be look like. You know, I don't know, like a person in Alabama wouldn't have a clue what you're talking about. I don't even know if they have an Alabama Turnpike. I think you got a lot of passages going. Once again, I'd probably consider cutting that list back. You used a lot of them. I'm trying to debate. I mean, maybe it works. Maybe just keep piling them in there. You had Jesus of the door, the bridge, the sheep. You were working with a lot of images and a lot of verses. We're kind of showing the way Jesus makes this way. Yeah, I'd say it's your judgment call. You know, do you want a lot of them? Just keep, you know, one of them will hit. You know, one of them will land. Or do you want to take one or two of those and just keep working with them visually? Picture it like this. Picture it like that. But the same image, you know, but you paint the picture for them. What does it mean that Jesus is a door or a bridge? But you got a lot of them going with a lot of different scriptures. And I think, well, probably if I were, you know, if it were up to me and I were just coaching you, I would say cut back the metaphors, choose one or two of them, and then just work with them a little bit more, tease the congregation along a little bit more with each one of them. But yeah, I think it all came together in the end and worked well, as I said, and I think you could cut it in half and have two good messages there. Zach, tell me what you thought of the experience.
I think it did pretty well. I know in the beginning, that was the most differences I made was at the beginning, with trying to make it more inductive. I think I did that. You guys can tell me later, I guess, but I did a little bit. I seemed to try to do that a little bit more in the beginning. I don't know, what do you think? I know you like you always keep with kind of one thing, one stick with one thing, and I think I did, but at the same time I almost feel like if you feel like there's two competing ideas in it. Like I know in the beginning I was on a lot of the foundation, the object of our faith, and not what our foundation is. And then which is Jesus and what he did ultimately rising to life, and then I come back and kind of, once I go through the passage, it's kind of like I leave that idea behind and I go through a couple other things, but maybe it's not, maybe it wasn't a big deal that you saw. I think one thing I thought, one of the points I had was trying to relate, thinking like this could be a good one for those who are new Christians, or it'd be good like an evangelistic sermon, I think. How can I make this? Good points to make for those who are, have been believers, but at the same time, how can I tie this in even more so for those who have been in the church for a while? And so I guess, I felt one or two points I could draw out more depending on what the congregation was, maybe. But, overall, it was good, I suppose. Yeah.
I felt you kind of stayed in one theme. I don't feel like you jumped themes a lot to me. I mean, I think everything was pretty close into what you're doing. I have some other comments. Ed, have comments from Brad or Angie here?
I think he was definitely more confident when he did it. He had, I think you and I talked about this, after class. Like, only thing I noticed is, he took some, I don't know, there was one pause, which, signaled me, I don't know, because I'm in the class, signaling that he had, lost his place or something, but he said that he did that a couple of times. But, other than that, I think he did good on delivering the message and, telling the stories that he was telling. About the bridge and it not being there, but having faith in it, and what the eyes saw is going to be the brain. Like, what are you going to... And I really enjoyed that, and him bringing that back and delivering it was really good for me. Like, the image of having faith in something.
Mm-hmm.
Not solid enough.
Mm-hmm.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
We used the quotation by Tozer, and I think that, you know, what faith in faith is faith amiss or something like that. That worked for me. I mean, I felt like that was pithy. It was the kind of quotation you want to use. Robinson talks a little about quotations there, and I think what, chapter 9, about why you quote and what you should quote. You know, you can shoot yourself in the foot if you pick the wrong quotation. But how about for you, Brad? How's any reflections on it?
Yeah, going along with what Angie said, the confidence, I could pick up on that. The kind of like, know exactly where we're going, what order we're going in. And yeah, I felt like there was more confidence and eye contact. That was really evident to us the second time around.
Colin's better.
I thought so. Maybe we should reword that to like into the eye contact. Because you did make eye contact the first time, I guess the second time, like focusing on us individually a little bit longer. Than before. Because, yeah, like both times the eye contact was fine. The second time it seemed like it was a little more, what do you call it? Like you're talking to somebody individually.
That's to make them guilty.
No. But I remember saying that in my just sort of general advice after the first time is you really don't want to have your face buried in your notes at the end of the message. That to be kind of reading your startling conclusion makes it little, not your startling conclusion, but to be reading it takes energy out of it. And I felt like everybody's finished stronger in that sense, looking at the congregation. Such as we are, all three of us, but delivering it like you didn't have to read it from your notes. Because if it's so important that you want the congregation to know it, and you've rehearsed it, I mean, the idea that you'd have to read it, there's something wrong there, that it's not just an appeal, a pitch, or a summary that they could do without notes. If you can't do it without notes, they can't do it without notes. You understand? So I felt like all of you actually finished strong in that regard. Yeah, what did I write down? I felt like, yeah, I certainly noticed how you developed it at the beginning and worked with that foundational element. I feel like very good. I think you could even give people more time or even play with that image more and not lose people. There's lots of room there. When you got to 1 Corinthians 15, you had the died, buried, raised as the core of the gospel. I think you've got it. I felt your use of Tozer's quote was rather good. Just right. The trail image, was that new? Did you use the trail and the car bridge thing? Or
I just kind of presented my hand a little bit differently. Like, I think the first time I tried to do the car bridge one, I told it as there's an example, or basically told it as a story that happened. So, but this time I said, imagine you're driving this time and you're going yourself. And the other time I said, there was a man who's driving and it was kind of like a narrative, like a little story. And I changed it that way. I think I did that in with the creep one too. I think I changed that just a little bit, but I did use that idea the first time. But just a little different.
I certainly picked up on it more, the trio part of it. You did the if-then stuff. I like that kind of thing. I felt like you spent enough time on it to explain what you if-then, you know, the consequences of Christ not rising from the dead. I feel like get into that territory. You're already stretching some people intellectually, not just people who are unsophisticated, but... You know, most people don't think about how they think or logical outcomes and things like that. So I thought, if you're going to go there, you need to explain what you mean pretty carefully. And I felt like you did, and that worked. You got to what? Ephesians 3:1, Romans 6:12. Let's see. and you had Romans 4:24 and 25. I feel like if anything, I would probably just, as I said, work with fewer of them. You got to John 14, forgetting what was it, Philip you were talking about then? No, that was Angie. You, John. Oh no, John 1:4. Oh, that's what you were talking about. That's right, right. Refresh my memory.
John 1:4.
In him was life.
Yeah, in him was life, and his life was the life
of man. Yeah.
Do you think there's plenty of passages?
Yeah. I don't know what to say to you about all that, because some people appreciate that. My inclination is that if you have like a main passage and you're working with a main passage, that maybe two at the most, three additional passages are probably all the reference you need. It'll start spinning too much if you get too many additional scriptural references going. I think you'd spend your time painting the picture of the images that are in your main passage, developing them a little more. Like I said, the idea is to do this without getting heavy-handed, without getting pedantic and just hammering the same thoughts, because people will get bored with that too. But if you keep, said you don't have to simplify, you don't need to be simple-minded, but you need to keep bringing things back to that main point and teasing it out, maybe with a newer and deeper thought with each compliment. What am I saying about my main point? Working that way. I felt like you did well at the end. Zach, just for a personal thing, I think one other person did, and I forget, don't look at the clock. Never look at the clock when you're preaching. Get a couple conspicuous looks up at the clock. It's always going to send the signal to the congregation that you feel you're in trouble or you're not planning correctly or something. Never look at the clock. Never look at your watch. There's a great picture of President Nixon, Dick Nixon, and he's going down a line, and the people are behind the barricades, and he's shaking hands, and a reporter caught him. He's got his hand like this. He's shaking somebody's hand and looking at his watch. It's just such a comedic photo, like, politician, I really care about meeting you. It's wonderful. But that clock is a danger. We should take it down. But you'll have it in a church. Often it's behind you. I mean, if the congregation's, but if they sense that you're looking at it and puzzling it for a moment, they'll think, what, whoa, is he going over? Yeah, what's, why is he looking at that clock? You know, I think it's funny. Okay, any other comments then on the repeat issue here? Well, you do this again, and as I said, I think. Be ready to slash and burn and change things around, drop things out, and you've heard my general advice. And once again, with preparing these sermons coming up, review your handouts, try to apply what's there, and look ahead in Robinson if you have to. Let's go to Robinson now. I think we're in chapters 6 and 7, aren't we? Are your chapters matching ours in your edition of the book, Angie?
Yeah.
Okay. Right, this is the Shapes Sermons take in chapter 6. Everybody there with me? I like some of this is a very simple book. I mean, it's not a profound book in the sense that it takes a lot of thought, but I like how it's laid out. For example, the stages in the development of expository messages. I mean, I think this would be gold for you preparing a message coming up. Select the passage, study the passage, discover the exegetical idea, analyze the exegetical idea, formulating the homiletical idea, determining the sermon's purpose, and now we're in these two elements that he has bold-faced here, determining how to accomplish this purpose and outlining the sermon. So I would think I would be using these things almost as a checklist as I was going through it. Even if you've sort of moved, your mind has moved things in a new order, I'd go back and say, did it include these things? How did I get the passage that I'm working with, and why am I working with it, and have I looked deeply enough into it? All right, so I'm once again just going to go through the things that I think were important to highlight here. Through the study of the passage, we should have determined the exegetical idea by stating clearly what the writer was talking about and what he was saying about what he was talking about. I mean, that comes very first. Now, in this case, I think it's odd because you're not in a preaching office where you'd be studying the scriptures and developing it that way. So there's probably a reason already you've moved towards a topic. And he has the elements, the three developmental questions: explain it, prove it, apply it, however you can approach it. From this we frame the homiletical idea that relates the biblical concept to modern men and women. That might be a necessary restatement or not. Remember, I thought his examples as to what would be universally true and not need restatement is probably naive in terms of that. I think more and more as I read this book now, working on it the second time through closely, I think this is an older guy who lives in the last century. I mean, he says at one point at the end of chapter 8 or 9, I think, this is the 21st century. And I'm thinking, yeah, you're kind of not in it, you know, in the way you're talking about this. So frame that homiletical idea. Okay, stage 7 then, and I believe that's more kind of where we are here in this chapter. Sermons develop in three major ways: deductively, semi-inductively, or inductively. So I said, I think for the most part, you're deductive. He doesn't have semi-deductively there, but if we put a fourth element somewhere between, if we were moving right, saying deductively, semi-deductively, semi-inductively, or inductively, and thought of them as a continuum stretched out, I think you guys would have been in the semi-deductive. In the deductive arrangement, the idea is stated completely as part of the introduction. And we said that in some ways this is the standard sermon. I'm going to tell you what my conclusion is, and I'm going to now prove to you why I'm right, is how the sermon goes. That works particularly for Christians. I think it doesn't lend itself to people who are skeptical who aren't Christians in some ways. I think the inductive approach is better. We find the inductive approach is growing as a comfortable place for a modern sermon. Inductive development. Here we have him developing it. Introduction leads only to the first point in the sermon. In other words, you don't give away your conclusion. Say that would be like going to a movie and finding out what happens to the hero in the end. I mean, even if you know what happens to the hero, you don't want to find it out in the first 5 minutes of the movie or the show. You want to let them take you to it. You want to suspend you say, well, wait, this show's on next week. I know the hero doesn't die. But somehow you can want to suspend that disbelief and say, she's in it now. How's she going to get out of this kind of thing? You let the story take you, and I think that's what they're saying here. Don't give away your conclusion in an inductive sermon. Introduction would only lead you to your first point, and then with strong transitions, each new point links to the previous point until the idea of the sermon emerges in the conclusion. It emerges in the conclusion. That's the inductive power. It's the punchline. We have teased out the problem. I mean, think of everybody's message here. How would it have been approached inductively? Well, think of how you would have, if you took all your messages, all your topics, and you, because you pretty much, as I said, you were mostly semi-deductive, I feel. You had inductive elements, but I kind of knew where you were going from the beginning. But if we took, say, Brad's message from, there's my dry marker, Brad's message on the torn veil, you would say, what was that term you used? Divided? What part? What was your word?
Torn divider.
You would leave that hanging all the way down to the conclusion, and then what would the conclusion be? Hanging doesn't, probably a bad pun there, but I mean, you'd kind of just, you wouldn't tell them why it was torn, right?
No, so like the torn divider.
Okay, keep.
Like torn divider was the result of Christ's death.
Christ's death, which does what?
Tears the.
Yeah.
Christ's death tears the.
So, but you'd hold that thought to the end. I mean, it would be the glorious conclusion. Why is that divider torn? Why was that divider there in the first place? What did it mean for people to be divided like that? And you would just keep bringing that around, and then really almost at the conclusion. But now we see that Christ's death has ripped the divider. And what does that mean for it? You know, now the problem that I've created, all this tension, there should be all this tension here about our relationship with God is concluded. If we do Angie's, where would we go if we were doing a deductive arrangement? We have, should we say Christ is our Passover? Is that an adequate summary? Well, we'd have all those problems, like the problems of Egypt, your own personal Egypt. We'd have all that problem of God and only being able to approach Him through His rituals and things like that. And then, at the very end, Christ comes and He's the Passover Lamb. He's the way to God. You know, we had all the images, the bridge, the door, I'm losing my thread with your message. But once again, you'd be filling in all this tension. You'd be leaving people hanging on this. Wow, that's a dilemma there. You know, they had to do this yearly. They had to go through all these rites and they were limited. Zach's sort of, I'm kind of maybe even blending it together with yours a little bit. So where's your first point is, if Christ's still in the grave or something, you know, if Christ, right, without the resurrection. You'd be teasing out this thought of what would it mean if Christ were still in the grave, and then you come to this conclusion, Christ is risen. But it would be the last part of the sermon, the last paragraph. That's inductive engagement, and I think it works really well.
Yeah. I think, I don't know, so with mine, I mean, there's like, figure four, five. I mean, there could be one main one, but there's like numerous points. If you want to impact me, do it, come to the conclusion. It's only like two of this very simple one main general. Okay, this.
Well, I think the key is that with that, if we play with Robinson's subject complement idea, each of the complements is almost more, as I said, you're building this tension into it. Like it's another question, another problem. How are we going to get out of this? You know, it's getting deeper and deeper, and then you hit that conclusion and race to the finish line because it's solved, you know, and that's that loop that I showed you that we haven't talked about much, getting worse and worse. Oh, here it is, and then off you go to the conclusion, and it works. Well, it's one way of doing it. I'm not suggesting everybody likes that. I have tended to preach inductively because I think it works well with people who don't know a lot and aren't unbelievers. But I had to teach myself to do it and every once in a while, I don't feel you have to lock yourself down to one thing. Another variation of the inductive and deductive development is that in your introduction, you lead up to your first point and develop it inductively. You may do that for the second point in the sermon where you will, for the first time, give the complete statement of your idea. Now, he has that chart there. Angie, do you have that chart? Does he have that? I mean, look at that for a moment, and you can see how that works. Left-hand column. In a deductive idea, your idea, your homiletical idea is just simply stated up front. You look at the inductive development and you see it's right at the bottom. Now the inductive deductive development is to plant the idea in the middle. So you tease people along a little more with your introduction. You rope them in. You create a little bit of tension for them and then you give them the idea and then you explain why your idea is sound. As I said, you are kind of almost to that place, most of you. You created a little bit more, fascination in your introduction. The subject completed development, subject introduced, and the idea stated as a subject with its three complements. That I'm not really sure why he thinks that's different. I guess what he's saying is that once the subject and idea is introduced, the things aren't necessarily sequential as much as they are just kind of developed on parallel tracks. Okay, let's see, what else did I underline here? I'm on 118, right above deductive arrangements. Just as any statement we make develops through explaining, proving, or applying it, so sermon ideas, too, demand explanation, validation, or application. And so I think we'll keep that in mind. What are you, your sermon idea, your homiletical idea? I mean, obviously, if you just stated it, you could sit down if it didn't need something. I teach a lot of adult Sunday school, and there's always that, there's not always, it's an exaggeration, there's often a person I'm teaching who you ask a question, and they've got a simple Sunday school answer, and they slap it in there right away, and you get the feeling like, as far as that person is concerned, at this point, we could all go home. You posed a question. Here's the answer. It's simple. It's blunt. It's direct. There's not really any point in conversing anymore about this because the answer has been given. And you think, this is a conversation stopper. So what I always have to do with that person is find the string to pull and say, yeah, but what about, you know, the place where it doesn't apply, where your simple take on it. Or have you ever considered what it would mean? So I think what we're saying is you've got this idea, of course, you don't want to just flatten it with every statement you make in response to it. You are explaining, validating, or applying. Okay, so we have deductive arrangements, and I've just underlined a few things. I'm down in the middle of that paragraph. In the introduction to such a sermon, we state the complete idea. In the body, we take the idea apart and analyze it. And in the conclusion, we repeat the idea again. Certainly, such a development wins through clarity. Certainly, such a development wins through clarity. Anything it loses in suspense. It does lose a lot in suspense. Then on 120, he's taken one apart by Alexander McLaren there, you'll see, and he just says, in this entire sermon, this is after his outline, we're getting close to the proposition to be proved section of this, I'm on page 120, in this entire sermon, McLaren does little else but answer the question, what does this passage mean? Okay. One other thing is essential. I'm at the top of 121. One other thing is essential in a sermon about an idea explained. Your introduction is crucial to its success. You must find a need for the explanation. The sermon form works only if you scratch your people where they itch. I think, well, that's true. I mean, you could spend a lot of time elaborating. I've heard this. A pastor wants to preach through the book of Timothy or Romans or something like that, and they get to a chapter it's clearly kind of an academic point, and so their elaboration of it may be perfectly valid, but it just isn't speaking to any kind of congregational need whatsoever. Maybe, for example, it's a problem a pastor would face, or a church administrator would face, or a person in a certain situation would, but you're speaking past 90% of your congregation. You have to be very careful in your selection of passages, and if you're doing a deductive arrangement, I think that advice is very good. Okay, a proposition to be proved. Deductive sermons take other forms. Sometimes an idea requires not explanation, but proof. We get that. It's interesting because he takes the same passage you were working with, Zach, there with Corinthians 15, doesn't he?
Yeah. That I had most of it together, else I probably would maybe take some of it.
Well, I think what I wrote was there's a problem here in one sense, and I didn't pick it up when you were speaking, but when I was looking at this outline, is I considered there's a logical fallacy called the ad baculum, argumentum ad baculum. It's usually in the modern sense described as the dire consequences of not believing somebody's point. The world will fall apart, civilization will end, you kind of use a scare tactic almost. You have to believe this or this will be the result. Well, of course, that's always open to question because nobody knows the future, and usually dire consequences are overstated, right? I mean, you say, well, everything's going to fall apart. Well, but no, things have a way of getting more complicated than all that. And I thought, well, it's very interesting. Some Corinthians must have surely wanted a resurrectionless faith, or they wouldn't have been in the church at Corinth to be addressed. In the passage, I think it would be very interesting to explore that particular thought. Why would you continue to be a Christian if you didn't believe in the resurrection? But I think in some ways I'd written down that. But some Corinthians obviously wanted a faith. Now let's see. Why did I respond to this particular message this way? Because I thought it wasn't a great example here. Yeah, I don't know. Okay, the other deductive arrangement, a principle to be applied. Third form of the deductive sermon. In this type sermon, you establish a biblical principle either in your introduction or your first major point. Then in the remainder of your message, you explore the implications of that principle. And then at the end of the deductive section, the three sermon forms we have discussed, an idea explained, a proposition proved, and a principle applied, are deductive arrangements of the sermon. In all three, your idea is stated in the introduction or the first major point of the sermon. What I'd do, since you're probably already working on this last sermon, is say, figure out, do you have a deductive sermon there? Which of these are you working with? And once again, there's room to mix all those things. All right, his next section, semi-inductive arrangements, a subject to be completed. He has one there. His example is this sermon form depends on a key word that holds the points together. In Stewart's sermon, it is the generic word things. Each of his 5 points is a thing about our fellowship when we come together to worship. Our complaint about the subject completed form of semi-inductive sermons is that it can be boring. But, okay, very good. I don't know if that could be more boring than a deductive sermon or not. We have induction-deduction then. Induction and deduction may be combined in your sermon. The idea is stated someplace in the middle of the sermon. You see that in the introduction, you discuss in personal terms a question, problem, or bewildering experience such as depression or grief. And then you demonstrate it actually reflects a more general theological or philosophical problem, and you offer a positive biblical solution in practical, usable manner. That's a very powerful method, I think. Induction, deduction. You just say, all right, something is amiss, or something is puzzling, or something seems incomplete, and then you think, well, you experience this personally in your life this way, but have you considered it as part of a larger cosmic issue? This is where the idea of sin, I think, begins to make sense to a modern person. Whereas a sin as a violation against God that offends God is a hard sell for an unbeliever because they don't feel guilty and they don't understand why an all-powerful, all-loving God would hold anything against them. It's very hard for them to understand that concept of sin. But they do understand a messed up life. What if you say sin leads to problems, maybe not now, but in the long run, and maybe pain, and maybe that pain then is the result of an alienation from God, and then begin to work with it, then sin begins to come into focus. Remember, we talked about that lingering guilt idea that preachers used to be able to work with, that I don't think a modern preacher really has much to go on there. If you talk about sin, you need to talk about why sin is sin and what it actually does to us. Okay, then inductive arrangements, and I'd like you to pay special attention to that. See if you could do your second message inductively. In your introduction, you do not state the complete idea of your sermon. But notice his point on 127 there, end of the second paragraph. If you are a fledgling preacher, what is a fledgling?
Barely surviving. Just starting kind of.
Yeah, well, fledglings are leaving the nest, right? They're learning to fly. Have you ever noticed how badly robins do when they're flying? I never noticed this when I was a kid. Robins are around. They're just coming out now. They're in the fledgling stage. Robins, you know the bird robin? They are horrible at flying when they're little. Look at them on campus. They crash into things. They land and tumble and things like that. It's amazing what they are like at that fledgling stage. I thought some birds are very graceful, like the swallows come out and line up on a wire, and they seem to be teaching their young to dive off the wire, and they have a little bit of trouble getting back up and settling there. But robins are just pitiful. I said they crash into things and tumble and take off badly and a mission aborted. Roll around on the ground. Watch them. Baby robins are hysterical. Anyway.
What's the bird that even through all their life they tumble, they can't land, they just flop and roll? There's some birds, they're just clumsy. I forget.
I don't know.
Anyway.
Just not made to do it, I guess. If you are a fledgling preacher, proceed with caution. Congregations who have been exposed to an inductive sermon at the hands of an amateur may still be wandering around trying to find their way home. I like that. Advantage, the sense of discovery. Learning truth for yourself. This is all in 127 middle paragraphs. Inductive sermons are particularly effective with indifferent or even hostile audiences. I've moved all the way over to page 129 then, the last full paragraph above the section there. The inductive sermon is closer to a conversation than to a lecture. Bottom of that paragraph. Inductive sermons work best when from beginning to end, from current problem to biblical solution, we are talking about actual people, not about cardboard characters in tissue paper plots. He also says that it's a story told. He talks about the narrative qualities of this. The drama isn't solved until the end of the last act. The joke leads to the punchline. The sports event moves towards the final score. Inductive sermons fit that way of thinking. That is particularly true of a specific type of inductive sermon, a story told. And that's narrative preaching. Narrative preaching on 130 now, however, does not merely repeat a story. Content supporting the points is drawn directly from incidents in the story. But story sermons are very, very powerful, or you think of your message as a story told. You can think of how that would work with any number of passages, really. It's going to be harder to do that if you take a didactic theological passage out of Galatians or Romans, but you could. You could cast it, just find the appropriate even biblical story or tell your own. I underlined in 131, does this development communicate what the passage teaches? Will it accomplish my purpose with the audience? Okay, stage 8 is on 131, and this is, he's moving us along here. This is the outlining the sermon. It begins on page 131. So if you're at the very beginning of the chapter and you see it, this is the second bold face here. 132, certainly no sermon ever failed because it possessed a strong outline. The outline is for your benefit. Congregations do not hear outlines. They hear a preacher speaking. Your outline, therefore, serves you at least four ways. First, you view your sermon as a whole. Second, it clarifies your idea of the relation between parts. Third, it crystallizes the order of ideas. And finally, you recognize places in your sermon that require supporting material. I don't often write an outline before I do. I think I speak enough that perhaps it happens somewhat automatically for me that I've got an outline. I'm thinking, I do think of messages towards their end. But I have, when I've gotten stumped or I've found that I feel like my thoughts are jumbled, I might just write down a main idea and a simple outline for it. I've tended to preach from full scripts mostly the last few years, but even when I was outlining, I felt like it's just as deceptive to start with an elaborate outline and go, you know, 1A to 4A and then conclusion if you're being slavish about it. You need to get out into the margin, I think, and make the simple outline. This is my beginning and this is my end and these are my points in between, so that if you're preaching from an outline, you might have a very fairly elaborate outline going here. But if you're just developing that as it goes, you're not really outlining. You're just creating an outline script to preach from. It's only when you have that view it as in its entirety that you've actually got an outline that's shaping the sermon. Otherwise, as I said, it's just a way of laying out your notes. Your thinking could be confused. I think the idea is the clarity of thought that you... do the simple outline first if you want to bring your thoughts back around. I think he gets at that in that second paragraph, 132. Outlines usually consist of an introduction, a body, and a conclusion. That's what you're after there. Once again, he often talks about writing the body first and the that's Stott, who likes the idea of writing the body first and then writing your introduction and conclusion. I'm flexible about that. All right, look on 134, sage advice, next to last paragraph. A sermon outline, in contrast, and this might tied to our didactic stuff, in contrast to one for a thesis or research paper, should be simple and have relatively few points. I would think 3 to 5 points would be the maximum. Keep in mind that each point in the outline represents an idea and thus should be grammatically a complete sentence. And it might be a great discipline to write that complete sentence. Each point should be a declarative sentence, not a conclusion. Careful. Because I feel like if you're preaching inductively, you need to know what the answer is, but it might be yet another question teasing you out to that end there. We're looking at 137 for further reading. I feel like it's a good chapter, but you notice verse-by-verse preaching and other sermon form has fallen out of fashion in recent years. Perhaps it has failed as much in the hands of its friends as in the hands of its enemies. Verse-by-verse preaching resembles playing a saxophone. It is easy to do poorly. Why do you think that would be? I agree with him, by the way. I feel it's fallen out of favor, and I agree it's suffered at the hands of its friends more than its enemies. This is 137 under for further reading, and it's the last full paragraph. Verse-by-verse preaching and other sermon form has fallen out of fashion in recent years. Perhaps it has failed as much in the hands of its friends as in the hands of an enemy. Verse-by-verse preaching resembles playing a saxophone, easy to do poorly.
What can you say? Like, if you're doing verse by verse, you still want to go for, like, you want to have a main idea. And it can be a big temptation, and I know it is for me, like, when I'm going verse by verse, to try to get every single little detail that I can possibly get and make it, like, say something. And if you get too much focus on all the particulars, you may lose focus on the big idea, and then people walk away with a bunch of details because they have no idea what you're trying to tell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. It's so easy to be pedantic, you know, heavy-handed with it. That's one thing. But remember that big word pericope? What is a pericope? Right. I mean, it has to do with cutting. But I mean, any passage you take sort of, when you isolate it, it has a main idea. It the passage itself is working towards an idea. Otherwise, you don't really have a pericope. I mean, you're just strolling through unrelated passages. It might be a lot like preaching from Proverbs or something. There would be passages in Proverbs that are lengthy, but if you took just those parts of Proverbs, for example, that are discrete Proverbs and just strung them together, you may find you're running out in 10 different directions in 10 verses, and it just won't be coherent as a sermon. It would be better probably to take one of those Proverbs and or find two of those Proverbs that are thematic within it and work with those, but to go verse by verse would be destructive. I feel it's just boring and pedantic and heavy-handed. It loses the big idea for the small ideas. But
we were just discussing this in our new doctrine class last night about some preachers or teachers that tend to overdo it, and like kind of like that whole then A, then B, like kind of thing, like, okay, he mentioned air 5 times in this passage.
Mm-hmm.
So since he mentioned air, in the Greek term, this is what air means, so therefore this is what it's supposed to mean, therefore this is what it is, which can, like, destroy the interpretation of what it's really trying to say, and then you have your congregation, like, thinking because it said air 5 times in this verse, say that means this is what this passage is actually saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's bad exegesis. Usually, I mean, it gives the appearance, perhaps, of sophistication, but in fact, it could really miss the point of a passage. Well, I didn't get to 7, making dry bones live. I would before we get to messages that we're going to be doing coming up. I would look at that in particular. I feel like I didn't underline or go over as much there because I felt like it was very self-explanatory in chapter 7, but it's pretty good. I thought 157, when he's talking about pastors of rural churches, he seems to have a bias towards a picture of city pastors who go serve rural congregations. It's on page 157 of my edition of it. It's kind of funny because I'm thinking, chances are, if you're in our Mennonite world, you may well find yourself as the rural person going to the city congregation, because most of the church plantings are happening in other bigger towns. And so you may want to take everything he says there and just turn it on its head and say, but yeah, my problem will be, you know, I grew up in the big valley and now I'm a pastor in Brooklyn. What do I do? You might just consider it. You might just consider it. All right, so we have messages coming up Friday. Remember to hand in a listening assignment. I don't know that we'll get to talk about it or not, but hand one in. I think it's very important, and we've got what we're doing Friday and Monday. Of course, we're starting in first period.